Now it might be leverage, maybe they have their own business, but I would say majority of the investors that I encountered, were high income earners and possibly even self-employed. So, there's still, if you're talking about cash flow quadrant, Robert Kiyosaki's work, they're still on the active side, the income quadrants, the E and the S quadrant. So how can I educate them that this investing in syndication is a powerful investment, relatively risk mitigated? How does the company I work with risk mitigate that? And then at the end, like, how are we shifting their income to the B and the I side of the quadrant?
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big. Whitney Elkins Hutton began her real estate career in 2002, and according to her, it was a huge success. And it was on her second deal that she almost lost it all. But since that first rental, she's partnered with over $700 million worth of real estate, ranging from 5,000 residential units and more than 1,400 self-storage units across seven states. She's also a guest on the Bigger Pockets podcast, episode number 340. And when she's not out scouting a new deal or meeting with new clients, you can find her on the trail running with her dog, mountain biking, camping, and spending time with her family. Whitney, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure's all mine. The same three questions I ask everybody who comes on the show is, where did you start? Where are you now? And very quickly, how did you get there?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, we could spend a lot of time there. So I started in 2002 with buying a house with a significant other. The relationship fell apart about a month later. And guess what? I had a house. I didn't know what to do. Everything was in my name. I was scared. And so I was young and I guess kind of dumb. I stuffed that house full of roommates. The house actually required quite a bit of repair. I didn't think in my right mind that I would be able to keep that house. Fast forward 11 months later, got the entire thing repaired. And, YouTube didn't exist back then. I had to buy the Home Depot 123 book to do all these repairs myself and sold the house, which was actually in hindsight, probably my number one investing mistake, and turned a profit of about $52,000. And then I realized I actually had not been paying for any part of that mortgage that whole entire time. And moreover, I've been putting money in my pocket every month. And that's when it kind of dawned on me, like, this is the best thing since sliced bread. Like, how many more of these deals could I possibly do? So, and then from there, I, scaled up a portfolio, generally live in flipping and house hacking, did a few more deals that way. And my husband joined me a few years later, and we realized we were, accumulating piles of equity, but we hadn't unlocked this golden handcuffs for ourselves. And we realized we needed to transition into buy and hold real estate cash flow, that cash flow. So rentals, you kind of head slap, like, there's a reason why people have been buying real estate and renting it out for years, thousands of years, actually. And we scaled up a portfolio of 30 FERS or rehab properties. And then we're still doing some flipping on the side, live and flipping, just regular flipping. And then we transitioned into multifamily real estate when my husband decided he wanted to have the ability to step away from his job. So, here we are today. We've focused very, very intently in the past 4 years on our multifamily real estate. And, where am I at now? Well, I'm trying to, just kind of balance back up the portfolio between real estate that I have in partnership with and then that I directly own.
Interesting. There's a lot of things of obviously, and I always put the caveat, quickly in there. You hit that. It's a good job. I know that's a tall order. What was the transition, when you said, okay, we single family, now we're going to multifamily. Like, how did you get your first deal done? What does that look like? I mean, walk us through that process.
Well, so our first rental, set aside the live-in flipping and the house hacking part of the story, because that was really just buying the roof over your head where you were going to live and utilizing the tax code or taking advantage of the tax code, really. I mean, it's legal to live in the property for 2 years, get it repaired, and then sell it at a capital gain and not pay taxes on it. I mean, that's one of the easiest glide paths into real estate. And it's so powerful. I don't think people realize how large of a gift that is from the IRS right now.
Right.
But when we transitioned to rental real estate, for some reason, and I work with investors in my coaching business. I mean, all of a sudden, like, the deer in the headlights process, they forget all about the translatable skills that they have if they've already bought a primary property. And that, I was no different. all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not living there. Like, what kind of loan do I get? Who's going to insure this property? Are they really going to pay every month? Like on time? Why would they do that? Like, I don't understand. So how we got our first property is we bought a property in our own backyard. So literally down the road about 10 miles in Westminster, Colorado. Actually, Broomfield. Me and very close. They're the two towns are close together. And, you know, we didn't know what we didn't know. I hadn't stumbled across Bigger Pockets, really hadn't even read a book about on how to analyze a deal property. We had capital. Other friends were doing it. So we were like, okay, this looks like a great property. It probably will hold its value. You know, napkin math. I'm probably making $300 or $400 a month. And I didn't include any sort of CapEx, maintenance, vacancy expenses. So that $400 a month was really only profit if the toilet didn't break or the fence didn't blow down, which all those things did happen. Now, we totally lucked out. We had some amazing tenants. We had bought, you know, we had not ignored the number one rule of real estate, which is location, location, location. I had already violated that rule before with the previous flip. So that much I knew. I had checked that box. But when it came to actually like analyzing the numbers, we had told it was an epic fail. So we closed on that property at the end of January. I stumbled across Bigger Pockets the next month, maybe 2 weeks later, joined one of their classes on how to analyze a deal. And I went, oh, crap. I'm like, cash flow, I think, was like 1.8%.
Wow. Annually or monthly?
Annually. Oh my gosh. It was 1.8% monthly. Like I would have been amazed.
I was like, wow, that sounds pretty good to me. I mean, almost 2% a month. Sure. Yeah.
No, okay, my cash on cash return annually was 1.8% after I had taken the account for all the expenses related to the property. And I went, okay, okay. I'm doing better than having my money sitting in a bank. But, you know, that doesn't take into account the, you know, any sort of depreciation losses I was getting on the property or, you know, anything like that. But that's really where I quickly transitioned into learning how to invest out of state, because at the same time we were trying to buy another property here in Colorado. And I'm like, it takes $80,000 at that point in time to get into a property and get it off the ground. I'm going to have two properties, each cash flowing 1.8% a month. That path to financial freedom is going to be so long. I need to find a different way. So I learned how to underwrite properties properly, research markets. And by that following April, I had two properties out of state.
That's awesome. And these were all both in the single family space.
Yep. One in Indianapolis, one in Kansas City. And by the end of that year, I had 10 properties out of state.
Wow. Good for you. That's awesome. That's awesome. When did you transition to multifamily?
Well, so about 2 years after that, we had scaled, after that first year, we decided to transition into, I had learned about the BRRRR, like how do you buy a property below value, rehab it, tenant it, refinance your money out. So recycle the same capital over and over again, because we didn't have endless supplies of capital. So we had to get crafty. And so we scaled up to about 30 units. And I, you know, that took about another year, year and a half after that. And then I went to my husband and said, hey, look what I've done. Isn't this amazing? I would love to spend more time with our daughter at home. I mean, she was super little. And, you know, that was just, you know, where I wanted to focus was being with my family. And he said, awesome. I want some of that. I'm like, wait, we did not include that into our financial plan. Now I head slap, right? Like I'm going like this. I'm like, why didn't we like plan for both of us to step away from our jobs? But at the time he said he didn't want to. That point in time, I was celebrating because I'm like, yes, he's coming to the dark side. He sees the power of real estate. And my heart sank because I'm like, I have to do probably at least another 40 or 50 more of these properties to get him out of his job, because he had all the benefits attached to his job. And I'm like, I don't know if I've got it in me to do another 50 BRRRR type properties in at the same clip that I had been doing them at. So that's when I was like, okay, we got to figure out, you know, scaling business. How do you scale? How do you add more doors? Like, you know, I had been in retail, you know, up until that point in time. I'm like, all right, we have to find a pot of money and we have to be able to close on more doors with one transaction. So that's where we transitioned into multifamily real estate.
That's awesome. Yeah. And that's a great feeling, you know, when, okay, I can step away, you know, this is now working the way it should. I'm sorry it wasn't met with the enthusiasm maybe that you were hoping more. I'm like, oh crap, we got to do this again. How did you find your first multifamily deal? How did you fund it? What were some challenges you ran into? And then how did you grow that portfolio?
Yeah, so that's kind of the interesting part of the story. And Sam, and you and I go way back on this. I actually skipped buying the whole multifamily property myself. Now, I had done a duplex and triplex and a quad, right? Like, for me, that's more residential real estate, but it technically falls in that multifamily realm. But I hadn't had been pushed to go find like a 6, 10, 20, 30 unit on my own. So at this point in time, I'm trying to, you're scaling, all your systems are breaking down. I need a new realtor, a new lender. I need a, maybe even a new market. I need a new way of analyzing the deal. And, you know, some of my skills translated, but, you know, I definitely had to re-engineer everything. Well, I had also invested in my IRA passively in a couple of multifamily deals where I was a limited partner. And the whole entire time I'm sitting here, you know, comparing what I could find in the market and acquire myself versus what was, you know, the returns I was getting in my IRA and really paying attention to how they were running that business. I'm like, I'm not beating the market, or at least that. So I was like, you know what? That's when it really dawned on me that most people who have success in multifamily real estate partner. And so that's what I focused on next, was trying to find partners to go into business with. And so I found, and that's where you and I met, is when I was working with Good Egg Investments. And so I joined Good Egg Investments as their first team member and their director of investor relations and operations, and, you know, scaled up my portfolio of passive investments through Good Egg Investments and doing some active deals on the side as well.
Right. Now that's awesome. I mean, because you got to come in, and again, we've participated on deals together, which has been awesome and I've enjoyed that, but you got to come in with Good Egg and participate not only as a limited partner, but as a general partner on these deals as well. No?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right. And that's a great way to scale. Talk to us about that method or that approach versus going out maybe and just, you know, being the, you know, direct or being the sponsor of the deal yourself out of the gate.
Well, for me, I've always, and this has been my whole life, you know, anytime I want to make a pivot within my career or learn a new skill, I first try to understand how can I get paid to learn, right? How can I get, and it's not so much like, how can I make money? Right? Because there's an exchange of value there. Like, I knew I had a skill that they needed. You know, I had come from operational and business background, right? And so that's very valuable to a business. So it's an exchange of value that we created together.
Gotcha. That's fantastic. And now walk me through that process, because I think, and I've had Annie Dickerson on the show. I think she came on show 8, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, the process with Good Egg, they came in basically on the front end, and I know things have changed, but as capital raisers with other sponsors, correct?
Yeah. I mean, not direct capital raisers, but yeah, kind of a hybrid model for sure.
A hybrid model. That's awesome. What were some key things that you picked up as you went through that process? You said, okay, I really like this, and that's something that other people implement.
Yeah. So for me, what the business needed was somebody to play catch to everything that, you know, all the different operational pieces of the business. One of the strengths I brought to the business is coming from a sales background, you know, when I was in public health, you know, or working in, you know, community pharmacy, like I had to convince people to make behavior changes that they did not want to make. I don't care how you slice it. That's a sales job. So, I mean, this is something I don't talk about, you know, in depth on a lot of podcasts, but one of my first public health jobs was, you know, trying to educate commercial sex workers on condom negotiation. Like, there's nothing much harder than that. You know, maybe working with an addict and trying to help them, you know, use a clean needle. You know, there's, you know, so I succeeded there. I'm like, I can sell ice to an Eskimo. You know, but you have to be passionate and believe about the product that you're selling, right? And for me, I had already come in knowing about the power of real estate. And so it was really, I felt this was more about how can I connect with as many people as possible and educate them about the power of real estate? And if you choose not to do it actively yourself, how can you get involved in another person's deal passively and create immense amount of leverage in your life? You know, by investing in an operating business, a credible known operator that has a track record and has the skills in place. They have the credit, they have the network, they have the team. They have other investor money coming in to access the deal. right? That is the main difference for me. You know, you ask the question like, okay, why didn't I focus more on doing it myself? Well, I didn't have the investing network, but I had the knowledge, right? And I think there's a power in, you know, plugging people into an already existing network if they can. Now, certainly, like once you learn those skills, it's definitely probably tempting to go out and strike out on your own. And I know a lot of people do. I think that kind of helps clear the hurdle because you're one, you're getting kind of paid for the education. Two, you're providing an immense amount of value exchange there. And three, you know, you're building your own personal network at the same time, you know, setting you up for better success if you do want to strike out and do it on your own, I guess, at a future date.
Right. Those are great points. What was, and maybe you already said this, and I apologize if you have to repeat yourself, but what was your role there with Good Egg?
Yeah, I was the director of investor relations and operations. And so my job was, with a title like that, those are generally split into two different jobs. You know, so I kind of was a catch-all to the entire business. But, you know, over time, majority of my role focused just on the investor experience. Like, how did they learn about Good Egg? Actually get into the ecosystem of Good Egg. And then how do we develop that relationship in order for them to feel comfortable in investing their hard-earned money? Remember, at this up until this point in time, majority of these investors are trading time for dollars. Now it might be leverage, maybe they have their own business, you know, but I would say majority of the investors that I encountered, you know, were high income earners and possibly even self-employed. So, you know, they're still, you know, if you're talking about cash flow quadrant, Robert Kiyosaki's work, they're still on the active side, the income quadrants, the E and the S quadrant. So how can I educate them that this investing in syndication is a powerful investment, relatively risk mitigated? How does the company I work with risk mitigate that? And then at the end, like, how are we shifting their income to the B and the I side of the quadrant?
That's an interesting discussion because I think, you know, for a lot of us, when we raise capital, we speak with people who already know about this business. I don't know, I'd say probably 8 out of the 9 out of the 10 people that I have investor calls with, new investor calls with, it's somebody that already has at least somewhat of an understanding of what's going on. But you were starting, it sounds like, with people that have more or, you know, basically no knowledge at all.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, when you look at, like, sales, right? You know, you take 100 people, 20%, you know, aren't going to engage you with you at all. Another 20% are going to, you know, already know, and they know, love, and trust you, right? They're already in, they're bought in. You don't have to explain anything to them. It's that middle 60% that has some varying level of knowledge. So, you know, if I'm talking about the investor, how do I make sure that, you know, they are comfortable with Good Egg? Right? You know, in that role that I was in, but like, you know, with anybody, like, how do you make sure they're comfortable with your business? Now, the flip side is you, if you are the one doing the capital raising, you have to risk mitigate your investment by making sure that investor knows the risks involved in the investment, right? So it's not so much having a conversation like, hi, like, what do you do? Like, how much money do you make? How much do you want to invest? You know, great. Do you have any questions? No, it's really, which I passively invest myself even now. I mean, I've had those conversations and I get off the phone. I'm like, they don't know anything about me. Like, I could be a terror to work with. And they haven't even like sussed that out, right? That is something that, you know, an operator, when they get on the phone with an investor, you know, they need to understand truly where does that investor, you know, fall in that educational continuum? Help them figure out the resources and fill in the gaps. I mean, they don't need to handhold them, but definitely have resources to help fill in the gaps. But, you know, risk mitigate their own business as well. Like, you know, get kind of like a temperature check and a personality check. Is this person going to make a good partner? I mean, even though they're a limited partner, are they going to make a good partner? Because you're going to be in business with them for 5 years, 7 years, 10 years.
Yeah. Talk to us about that. What were some things maybe that, you know, would give you pause when an investor came to you and you said, you know, maybe this isn't a good fit for us?
Yeah. I mean, I think on an initial level, just the interaction you have with somebody, like what kind of gut feeling do you get from them? Or do they seem personable? Are they somebody that you can kind of get along with? You know, and that has varying degrees in and of itself. I mean, I don't need somebody, you know, when I'm conducting an investor relations call, I mean, it doesn't have to be all roses, but are they treating me kindly and politely? Are they respectful? you know, that those are things that I look for in, you know, with a limited partner. Two, after that, I would challenge, like, what kind of questions are they asking? Right. I think the questions are going to clue you into their level of knowledge and expertise. I've always invited questions. There are no dumb questions. I want to know if you have any, and let's get them solved now, because the investor's less of a risk to the investment for me if they have all their questions. I mean, I've had investors that have closed on a deal and then came back, and then all of a sudden they have a laundry list of tax questions and legal entity questions. And while I'm not the, you know, not giving out tax or legal advice, I'm really like, whoa, these all should have been asked up front. How did we get this far? And then, you know, now these questions are out on the table. So if that does occur, I'm trying to fill in those gaps as quickly as possible.
Right. Yeah. On the investor relations side, I'm sure as you receive that feedback, you go, oh, okay, maybe this is something we need to put out some more information on.
Yeah. Make it part of the investment process, the investment deck, ask that in our investment calls, you know, or, you know, just do bring in more experts, you know, to talk about those topics and put that information out.
How did you do that? How did you bring in more experts in the onboarding of investor process?
You know, there's a couple of different things. One, just putting together, I mean, both of them are, you know, are going to kind of seem fairly direct and simple. And it really is. One, you know, putting in the investor's hands a resource document that if you have questions about, you know, taxes, here are some people that we suggest talking to, and giving more than one option. Because if you give one option, it's a recommendation. I come from public health. You can't, the R word, recommendation, is illegal for me to say as a public health worker. I cannot say recommendation. I can say my suggestion, here's some advice, but the R word is reserved for somebody who has a PhD or a Juris Doctorate. Like, you know, that's the world that I come from. So making sure that you put, you know, together a resource document for that investor to engage in, and maybe putting it in front of them more than one time. And two, another thing that I really enjoyed doing is I would conduct a weekly webinar. You know, there would be an educational topic, you know, involved there, but also I would stay around to answer Q&A. And sometimes those webinars, I would bring on one of those people in my resource document, my favorite people to work with, just to talk about all these questions that we've been accumulating over time. And those type of webinars, the expert session webinars, were, you know, highly valuable. Right. You know, again, it just boosts the level of the operator's know, love, and trust factor. But, you know, again, you get that investor to yes faster.
Right. And that's ultimately, you know, ultimately getting the yes is not the end all be all necessarily, as we just talked about. Maybe sometimes getting them to know.
Or no. Yeah.
Right.
Close that gap.
Right. Right. Is the other answer. So fast forward now to where you are today. So that was what you did with Good Egg, which that's awesome experience. And that kind of that built the launch pad for where you are and where you're going next. What does that look like?
Great question. So I am, you know, right now I'm focused. I've always had a coaching and consulting practice, you know, helping, you know, investors acquire like their first couple of properties and scale up to 20 to 30 units. And so, you know, I've been working in that business for about 4 or 5 years now. And so I'm just continuing to enjoy that work. Right now, my daughter's still at home from COVID, you know, homeschooling from home. So I'm a parent, I'm a wife, I'm a mom. So I'm definitely focused in those areas. And then just expanding my own portfolio. I mean, I think that is, you know, something that can be a challenge for investors, and why, you know, investing as a limited partner can be so attractive is that I need to grow my own portfolio. And it was challenging for me, even working within the business, to find the different type of investments that I wanted to invest in. I'm super heavy into real estate and multifamily real estate. And so, like you and I were talking before the show, it's like, how can I diversify my portfolio into other non-correlated real estate assets? And even, you know, my eyes have been opened up passive investing beyond real estate, if you can imagine that.
Right. No, that's awesome. That's awesome. I've really enjoyed this. We're unfortunately out of time. I've got so many more questions to ask you, but what do we do? I guess before we jump into the final four questions, is there anything else really here on your journey that you'd love to share with our investors that you might think would be beneficial to someone who is looking to scale their portfolio?
Yeah. So, you know, if we're talking about actively or passively, I think really, you know, as I work with investors, the number one thing is analysis paralysis. People stay in the data gathering stage so long that they forget that they have to take massive action. Like if you don't take action, you don't have any progress. And so really making sure that you setting a timetable on yourself in order to take action, whatever that action looks like. So, you know, we're really good about holding appointments for other people and attending work meetings and meeting those deadlines. Set that type of thing for yourself. Okay. You have a business, treat it as such. Your investing is a business.
That's awesome. I love that. I love that. That's great advice. Final four questions for you are this. If I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate with no previous real estate investing experience, what would you do with it and why?
Ooh, this is again, another thing that I run into quite often, you know, $20,000, you know, is a challenge. Like, what do you get started with? You have to invest in yourself first, right? You have to invest in your knowledge. Now, do you have to spend $10,000 on working with a guru? No, I think there's a time and place for that, but you have to start somewhere, you know, get involved in a mastermind group, read some books, you know, attend meetings, attend a conference. Right? Conferences, I think at the very beginning are great crash courses to highlight some skills that you might need, get introduced to the mindsets that you might need, but network, right? You're going to need mindset skills and networks in order to succeed.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great piece of advice. Second question for you is this, if you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
I think the number one biggest mistake is inaction. So, you know, treat this like a business, right? And if you, you know, self-employed, this is just another arm, you know, of your business. Set the deadlines, like set your strategic goals, make sure they're measurable, make sure that they're, you know, relevant and time-bound. If this is a new concept for you, find somebody who's already done this or has at the next level that you want to be at and get as close proximity as you can to them. Maybe be in the same mastermind group with them, attend the same meetings. Reach out to them and see if, you know, they will mentor you. I mean, there has to be some sort of a value exchange there. That's why a lot of mentors do get paid for their services, but definitely get in close proximity.
Right. That's great. That's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
I am very passionate in making sure that kids, especially like in my sphere, and I'm working with a partner here in the community that I live in, educated on finances. What is money and how does it actually work? That's super passionate for me. I mean, and I can't say that I have all the education there necessary, but it's called being a leading learner. So that I think, you know, just being empowered to take charge of your finances earlier is probably one of the best gifts that we can give the next generation.
Oh, for sure. And if you look at our public education school curriculum, that you'll learn how to do calculus, but not basic finance by the time you graduate high school, which is astounding. So good for you for doing that.
Well, I have a really quick story if you'll allow me to share.
Go for it.
Yeah. So this is pre-COVID, a couple of years ago, I was invited to, you know, parent teacher day. Like I kind of went into the classroom and the teacher actually invited me into the classroom to kind of introduce what I wanted to do. My daughter was like, please don't talk about money. Please don't, please don't. Like, I mean, she's seven. Right? I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm embarrassing my child at seven.
Right.
Like, okay. How can I make this as fun as possible? So I gathered up some Monopoly money, went into the classroom and I had divided the class up into three businesses. Like there was an ice cream shop, a soda shop, and then like a candy shop. And you would not believe at the end of the hour, like they understood income, expenses, assets, liabilities. And I'm like, if they only got those four words, that's all I need them to know. They figured out themselves how to partner their three businesses together to make an ice cream shop that sold candy and sodas together at seven. So, you know, there's so much power there to be harnessed, so much brain power to be harnessed there and enthusiasm too. So, we hold off in teaching these skills to high school. I don't understand why.
Yeah, I don't either. And you at best at high school. I mean, yeah, that's awesome what you're doing there. I do appreciate that. Whitney, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, you can find me at ashwealth.com. You can also reach out to me via email at ashwealthco@gmail.com.
Awesome. Whitney, thanks so much. Do appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It's been great.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.